The Artistry of Clyde Edgerton, Readings, Conversation, and Music, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for part 5 of New Southerners, a series of programs that explores the work of contemporary Southern writers. Novelist Clyde Edgerton is here to read from and talk about his writing.
I see my role in a way as going out into my backyard and looking for certain rocks that I think other people would like to see, and I put them in a big bucket, and I might have to polish some, I might have to crack some in two, I might throw some away, and then I look through my bucket and see if I've got my rocks arranged just right.
You're an archaeologist.
Well, I could be, maybe in another life. And then I take those that bucket of rocks into the house and let someone, an editor, help me examine them to see that they're placed right, that they're polished at the right places, rough at the right places.
Writer Clyde Edgerton. He'll be back in just a moment to read from and talk about his work. Later on the show this week, you'll also hear the music of Clyde Edgerton and the Tarwater Band. Major funding for this program comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Since 1985, when he published his first novel, Clyde Edgerton has become a favorite of readers and reviewers alike, not only in his native South, but nationwide. Edgerton's books include Rainy, Walking Across Egypt, The Floatplane Notebooks, Killer Diller, and In Memory of Junior. In its own way, each of these novels explores life and manners in the contemporary South. They also illuminate issues that transcend region, love and loss, family and separation, faith and loyalty. But in his writing, Clyde Edgerton avoids abstractions, preferring instead to present the rhythms of Southern speech and behavior. In the novel In Memory of Junior, for instance, a book with death much on its mind, one of the characters, Uncle Grove, remarks that your history longer than your fact. In another novel, with a nod toward magical realism, Clyde Edgerton gives voice to an ancient vine in a family cemetery, a vine that provides a kind of narrative genealogy. Clyde Edgerton was educated at the University of North Carolina, has taught at both the high school and college levels, served as a pilot in the United States Air Force, and was a winner of both a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Lyndhurst Prize. He's also enjoyed the distinction of seeing one of his books banned in a school district in rural Virginia. Finally, as a musician and composer, Clyde Edgerton is a member of the Tarwater Band, which you'll hear from later on Soundings this week. Right now, though, he's here to read from and talk about his fiction, beginning with an excerpt from his first book, a novel entitled Rainy.
We get married in 2 days, Charles and me. Charles's parents are staying at the Ramada, wouldn't stay with any of us. And today, me, Mama, Aunt Naomi, and Aunt Flossie ate lunch with Charles's mother, Miss Shepherd, and found out that she's, of all things, a vegetarian. We ate at the K&W. Mrs. Shepherd wanted to eat at some place we could sit down and order, like a restaurant, but Aunt Naomi strongly suggested the K&W. She said the K&W would be more reasonable and the line wouldn't be long on a Thursday, so we ate at the K&W. I got meatloaf. Mama got meatloaf. They have unusually good meatloaf, not bready at all. Aunt Naomi got turkey. Aunt Flossie got roast beef. And Miss Shepherd didn't get any meat at all. She got the vegetable plate. When we got seated, Mama says, I order the vegetable plate every once in a while myself. Oh, did you get the vegetable plate? Says Aunt Naomi to Miss Shepherd. Sure did, says Miss Shepherd. I've stopped eating meat. We all looked at her. I got involved in a group in Atlanta, she said, which was putting together programs on simple living, and after a few programs, I became convinced that being a vegetarian, me that is, made sense. Somehow I thought people were born as vegetarians. I never thought about somebody just changing over.
Music. Clyde Edgerton, always a pleasure to have you at the National Humanities Center. Welcome back to talk about your books. You got five of them and another one in the works, am I right?
That's right. It's good to be here. It's good to be back.
We just heard you read from Rainey. Tell me who this woman is and why she's... Well, what's special about her as a Southerner, for example?
Well, I think I first came up with her voice responding to a family tension. And once I got the voice, I realized that I had a person who could be classified as a lower, middle-class, white woman. Uh-huh. And that was attractive to me to write about such a person, because I think in perhaps contemporary life, especially in the past or in the media, this kind of person may get less attention. It seems that in literature we need to write about very poor people or very rich people, and these middle class or lower middle class, quote, people get less attention. So I had one, and I felt that she was a live wire and deserving some attention.
Now, what about the fact that she's talking to us here about what it means to be a vegetarian? There are people who are vegetarians all over the United States, but there's something particularly Southern going on here, is there not?
Well, the book takes place in 75, and here is, she's probably, Rainey, my guess is, has read a little bit about what a vegetarian is, but has not been exposed to a real live one face to face, and suddenly she is, and she's surprised that when she finds out that the vegetarianism was a matter of choice rather uh-huh. than not. She thought vegetarians were born as vegetarians.
She's looking for hooves and a tail and something. Who's the outsider and who's the insider? That's what you're writing about.
Right, in this particular case, for sure, and the fact that this woman, who's in a way coming in her family as a vegetarian, is a little bit shocking, because Rainey's not sure what that means.
Uh-huh. She wants to be respectable, and yet she is fearful of trying things that are new, talking about things that are normally not talked about. Is that a sign of the contemporary South, Clyde?
I think less so. I think that might be one of the changes. It's difficult not to talk about what is being talked about on television if you're watching television, and people I know who would not normally talk about certain subjects if they watch Oprah end up talking about those subjects. So there is a kind of more likelihood of finding certain conversations on certain topics going on than 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
How conscious are you, Clyde Edgerton, when you write a book like Rainey, of what is happening in the South? That is to say, the South is becoming more like the mass culture of the United States, or the other way around. I mean, it's not uncommon to go into any major city and find a popular country in Western radio stations to find palpable influences of the South that are not just geographically limited. Is that part of your agenda as a writer?
I think usually I'm concentrating on a particular family, a particular character, uh-huh. and in some ways this will automatically reflect the culture, the environment that this person is living in, but I usually don't ask those kind of questions, nor do I try. I try to particularize rather than generalize, and when you go one way, you're automatically going the other way, I think. But I'm thinking about a family and what is happening in that family, and so the decisions that the family has to make, or individuals in the family, certainly depends a great deal on what's going on around them. But my eye, as I write, is on the room that the family is in. My eye is not, I'm not reading newspapers to find out what to put in the story. And it's a combination of imagination and experience and observation. And my experience and observation have been in the society as it's changed since 1944.
Sure.
My eyes opened first in 44, so I've been watching since then. And much that I've gathered in, I think, has been unconscious, and some has been conscious.
Let me ask you to read again, Clyde. We'll jump forward to your most recent book. That's called In Memory of Junior. Here you're going to read to us in the voice of Gloria, who is a black woman in her, mid-60s, possibly early 70s. She's a practical nurse, and she's watching over Glenn and Miss Laura, two people married who are dying simultaneously, and the question in the book is who's going to die first, because that is what will generate much of the action in the novel. Read to us here for a moment.
Okay. Miss Laura, she propped up in there in her room on the pillows, leaning to the side a little. I go in and push her back up straight every once in a while. Mr. Glenn, he flat on his back in his room. His great big head looked like a yellow salt lick somebody carved his face in. They both mighty sick, have been some time. And you know, all these white folk worked up because of this tension. Whoever die first will mean who get this whole place. His boys? Or her daughter. The hospital won't take either one because you know how the hospitals are, and right now it looked like Miss Laura, she might actually be the first to pass, which would mean those boys would get the place. Because Mr. Glenn and Miss Laura own the place joint ownership, at least that's the way I understand it. And this place, the land, if it gets sold, will bring more money than would fill up heaven. Something like $3-4 million is what they say. Land going $80,000 an acre around here. You believe that? My granddaddy would die again if he knowed that. He owned 2 acres, bought them for something like $30-35 an acre, and that was high back then. Mr. Glenn and Miss Laura, they feel okay about each other. They always asking how the other one doing, except Miss Laura lately, she don't talk much no more. It's the families with the hard feelings. Her daughter, his sons, his sisters. Clyde, you say, here you've just read to us from In Memory of Junior, you say that your books come out of family. I mean, in at least two of your books, you got a genealogical chart at the front end of it. So I take it that this means that you're always looking at particular individuals to drive your stories. It seems I have most success, or I feel that I'm most successful when a story is character-driven. If I stumble onto a character, and of course in each character there are worlds, so... this character comes from somewhere, and I capture that or find that character and let that character talk or either watch and describe what that character's doing. And if I'm unlucky, the character will not be interesting, will not strike me, will not know how to behave. By not know how to behave, I mean that I might have to keep thinking about what that character should do, and I might have to be making up what that character should say, rather than the character acting on his or her own. But if I can get several characters acting on their own, and I'm lucky, then the characters will help me decide what the story is to be. And simply, and that happens, I think, any time a writer writes about a particular place and a particular time, which most fiction writers end up writing about a particular place and a particular time.
Well, what is it, Clyde? Is there something in the water, something in the soil that creates these memorable characters that you Southern writers, that you particularly as a Southern writer, manage to concoct in these books?
I think maybe we're able somehow. I think maybe it is something in the water. So that's the end of that. I think maybe finding somehow we're able to find the detail, the detail, and certainly all writers have done this from whatever region, and I'm sure people examine Southern writing, and it would be an interesting little search to see how details are used to bring alive certain characters. But I believe in many of our lives, if our parents were out of a rural kind of storytelling background,
and that's you.
That's true. I've heard many stories in my family about family people, and often there's a tiny. The emphasis is not on how Uncle Alfred was, or what he was like, or what he believed, or the emphasis is on one thing he said.
Well, I want you to read to me again this is the voice of an omniscient narrator. It is not the voice of little Vernon himself, but here is a passage, Clyde Edgerton, from your book, Killer Diller.
Okay. Vernon Jackson sits on the side of his bed in his white jockey undershorts, which have mostly separated from their waistband. It's 6:30 on a Monday morning in September. Vernon is 16 and small for his age. He has short, spiky black hair, and his pointed face looks so much like a possum's that Vernon is sometimes called Possum. His elbows are together in his lap, and he rocks back and forth. He reaches for the wire-rimmed glasses on his bedside table, a large cardboard box with Napa parts written on the side. He puts the glasses on slowly, they are too small, and looks through thumbprints for his T-shirt on the floor. He finds it, picks it up, turns it in his hands, first one way, then the other, then starts the sleeve opening over his head. It won't go on. Too tight. He looks down into the space inside the shirt, gets his bearings, turns the shirt around, and pulls it over his head the right way. A wind-up alarm clock on its back in a cooking pot out in the hall will ring in about 30 seconds. Then, after Vernon and his daddy, Hollister, find something to eat, Vernon will follow Hollister out to the Sunrise Auto Repair Shop in the side yard and help out until the school bus comes. Vernon is in special education. The alarm goes off. Vernon hears his daddy's feet hit the floor in the next room. The same thump as always.
Clyde, should we take this little boy, this little Vernon Jackson here? I mean, I come away from this and I think, man, this is depressing stuff. This poor kid is in bad shape. Is that because he's a Southerner?
I don't agree that he's in bad shape, although I agree that the reading and the part that I read could lead one to believe he's in bad shape. One of the ways he's lucky is that his father loves him. And there are enough poor children in the world who aren't loved, and rich children who aren't loved too. I think if I write about a character and that character has a parent who loves that character, then in many ways that character is lucky. I've recently decided, when I was thinking about answering questions on this program, often when someone asks me, what are you trying to do when you write fiction, I usually avoid or work around that question and say, well,
messages
I'm just
trying, and agendas and all
trying
of
to
that.
Tell a story. But I thought about, I tried to come up with an answer, and I think one thing I try to do that I haven't realized that I try to do, and it's fun, I do it because it's interesting, is I try to make little people big and big people little. As a storyteller, I gather from my own backyard stones. I polish them in certain ways. I make them rough in certain ways, and I put them into a little bucket, which I think will bring a certain amount of pleasure to people, depending on that person's point of view and relationship to the world. I go through the house, and the editor helps me get the rocks in just the right place, polished just the right way. I go into the front porch. A publisher reproduces those little buckets and passes them out to people who are willing to pay $15 or $20, and those people then sit down with that little bucket and start pulling out rocks. And the first rock one person pulls out, that person may pull that rock out and say, wow, that reminds me so much of what happened to me, and thank goodness someone else knows what happened to me. Person B may sit down with that little bucket and pull out that first rock and say, that is ridiculous. No wonder I hate the South. Or, that is ridiculous. How could anyone believe that? And I'm not going to look at any more of these rocks. So I gather my rocks in my backyard and put them into a bucket in a way that brings me a certain amount of pleasure, and a way that I'm conscious that my unconscious is helping me select and order.
Clyde Edgerton, we're talking about your life and work as a Southern writer. Let me put a couple of terms on the table here. The Old South and the New South. How do you come to those?
Well, I think the New South, perhaps, or in the New South, we've been able to start to grab a handle on legal racism, sexism. Maybe we're starting to look at how we treat homosexuals. We're starting to look at how we treat old people. So in the contemporary South, we are examining certain problems that were unexamined in the old South.
Do you have a responsibility as a writer to talk about those things? I mean, is there some sort of compulsion here that moves you to include themes like that in your fiction?
I think unconsciously, and I would hope that I would be working on any of those problems, which are really a matter of denying humanness, denying humanity, a withdrawal of kindness. I think unconsciously I'm working on that. As I began to consciously specify, and then I become an essayist. I become someone other than an artist. And I look for that, and when I get ready to write an essay, I'll try to write an essay and do. But when I'm writing fiction, often the attempt to write an essay to specify a specific social problem would be distracting, or at least to me as a reader, distract me from the story. So therefore, I try to keep that out of what I'm doing. But I find that also we have in the New South, in spite of the handles on some of these problems perhaps, we have the same problem, the arrogance of power, which existed in the Old South. And we have it in different ways. I think we often have it in organizations, formal workplaces, where in the Old South you had the family, and you may have had an arrogance of power in the family, but you had a certain kind of loyalties in the family. And certainly there are good and bad sides of all families. But we have now in the New South so many organizations. People go to work for someone else. And if in these organizations there is a lack of democracy, if there is a lack of fairness and kindness, you've got an arrogance which needs to be worked against.
Now, how do you in a way, Clyde, you set yourself up to fail when you take on large questions like that as an artist. Granted, if you're writing an essay, you can say, this is what I believe and this is the way we ought to change our society. Can't do that in fiction.
No, what I can do in fiction, though, is, as I mentioned a while ago, I think I can make big people little and little people big. And if I can make a little person have some sort of faith in fairness and rightness, and it can bring that to an organization, it can have a local, small effect that is positive and moral.
Clyde Edgerton is the author of 5 novels, including Rainy, Walking Across Egypt, The Floatplane Notebooks, Killer Diller, and In Memory of Junior, all first published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Reading from his second novel, Walking Across Egypt, here again is Clyde Edgerton.
Maddie walked into the kitchen, turned on the light, and saw through the window that the eastern sky was dark red. It was her favorite time of the day. She stepped out onto the back step. It was cool. She also liked it when it was cold, and she could stand there taking in the cold morning while the sky was red and time stopped, stood still, and rested for a minute. People thought that time never stood still, except in Joshua when the sun stood still, but she knew that for a minute before sunrise, when the sky began to lighten, showing dark, early clouds, there was often a pause when nothing moved, not even time. And she was always happy to be up and in that moment. Sometimes she tried to stand perfectly still, to not move with time not moving, and it seemed that if she were not careful, she might slip out of this world and into another. That made the moment risky, bright shining, and very still at the same time. She hoped that when her time came, it would be close to morning, and she could wait for the still moment.
Writer Clyde Edgerton reading from his second novel, Walking Across Egypt. The program is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part 5 of New Southerners, a series of programs that explores the work of contemporary Southern writers. To conclude the show this week, here's Clyde Edgerton and the Tarwater Band.
You knock down the refrigerator, I knock down the door. The Airstream tires are now flat, we don't live here no more. I just dropped by to look around, it's our anniversary night. I might be drunk, but this I know, two lefts don't make a right. You left left, I left, but two lefts don't make a right. Why couldn't we just sit and talk? Why did we stand and fight? You took the dog, I took the cat on that fateful night. Sometimes I wish I'd got the dog. Two lefts don't make a right. We tried it for a solid year. We tried it 6 months more. Now 6 more months have done gone by. We don't live here no more. I think the twins are missing and the bathroom is a sight. I think I'll cry cause this I know. Two lefts don't make a right. You left, I left, but two lefts don't make a right. Why couldn't we just sit and talk? Why did we stand and fight? You took the dog, I took the cat on that fateful night. Now I wish I'd got the dog. Two lefts don't make a right. Mama, and you went home to Dad. The dog pen is standing still and empty, it looks sad. He was a blue tick hound dog, mostly black and white. Of course I loved you more than him. Two lefts don't make a right. You left, I left, two lefts don't make a right. Why couldn't we just sit and talk? Why did we stand and fight? You took the dog, I took the cat on that fateful night. I'll trade you the cat for the dog. Two lefts don't make a right. Then maybe we can try it again. Two lefts don't make a right.
The music of Clyde Edgerton and the Tarwater Band. Their latest album is The Devil's Dream. The program is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Part 5 of New Southerners, a series of programs that explores the work of contemporary Southern writers. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like to have an audio cassette of this week's show. Upcoming segments in New Southerners will feature Kay Gibbons, Dory Sanders, Jill McCorkle, Tina McElroy Anza, Brent Wade, Randall Keenan, and Robert Olin Butler. For an audio tape of this program, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 705. That's program number 705, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. Major funding for this program came from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.